United States government.
This is VOA News. I'm Tommy McNeil. The UN Security Council held an emergency meeting Tuesday to discuss Russia's missile attack on Children's Hospital in Kyiv. Details from VOA's Jeff Custer.
A Russian spokesman Tuesday claimed the hospital was struck by a Ukrainian air defense missile, but a UN analyst said examination of video footage shows the hospital was hit in a targeted attack by a Russian missile. Speaking during the Security Council meeting, U.S. UN Ambassador Linda Thomas-Greenfield says the attack shows Russian President Vladimir Putin's true intentions.
As if there was any doubt that this was the case, yesterday's attack makes abundantly clear Putin is not interested in peace. He's committed to wreaking death and destruction in pursuit of his war of aggression.
UN officials noted intentionally directing attacks against a protected hospital is a war crime. Meanwhile, the Russian UN ambassador dismissed the accusations as pro-Ukrainian propaganda. Jeff Custer, VOA News.
NATO leaders are gathering in Washington this week as a military alliance confronts the prospect of the return of a NATO skeptic, Donald Trump, to the White House. Summit kicked off Tuesday and heads off state will work to shore up transatlantic support for Ukraine in its battle against Russia. More from National Security Communications Advisor John Kirby.
You're going to see some announcements on deterrence capabilities, not just with respect to helping Ukraine, but boosting the alliance. You're going to see some announcements with respect to the defense industrial base and how to shore up that and make it more resilient and invest in it more, including in our own industrial base here in the United States. And you're going to see, as I alluded to, some discussion about Ukraine's path to NATO and what that can look like.
Heavy Israeli bombardment is shaking Gaza City. Thousands of fleeing Palestinians have been searching for shelter and medical facilities have been forced to shut down. This is VOA News. A Russian internet propaganda campaign backed by the Kremlin that spread disinformation in the United States and relied on artificial intelligence has now been disrupted. That is according to the U.S. Justice Department, which announced Tuesday that it seized nearly 1,000 bogus social media accounts. Officials describe the operation as part of an ongoing effort to sow discord in the U.S. through the creation of fictitious social media profiles that purported to belong to legitimate users but were actually designed to advance the aims of the Russian government, including by spreading disinformation about its war with Ukraine. AP correspondent Charles de Ledesma looks at the United Nations report on the Taliban's morality police unit.
The Taliban's morality police are contributing to a climate of fear and intimidation among Afghans, according to a new UN report, which underlines that edicts and some of the methods used to enforcement, disproportionately impacting women and girls, constitutes a violation of human rights and fundamental freedoms. The Taliban had set up a ministry for the propagation of virtue and the prevention of vice after seizing power in 2021. The UN mission in Afghanistan goes on. Human rights violations, as well as the unpredictability of enforcement measures, contribute to a climate of fear and intimidation among segments of the population. I'm Charles de Ledesma.
AP Washington correspondent Sagar Magani reports a U.S. Federal Reserve's chairman suggests interest rate cuts may be getting closer.
The Fed's benchmark rate is at a two-decade high as the central bank keeps fighting inflation.
Over the past 2 years, the economy has made considerable progress.
But at the same time,
elevated inflation is not the only risk we face.
Chair Jerome Powell tells a Senate panel the Fed is also facing a cooling job market, and cutting rates by too little or too late could hurt economic activity and employment. While that suggests the Fed is nearing a move to cut rates, Powell did not say what Wall Street investors are anxious to hear, any strong indication of when cuts might start. Economists expect they will begin at the Fed's September meeting. Sagar Magani, Washington.
Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi has met with Russian President Vladimir Putin in Moscow, seeking to deepen the two nuclear powers' relationship as NATO leaders gathered in Washington. And Russia had launched deadly missile strikes in Ukraine that destroyed a children's hospital. Modi is on his first trip to Russia since the full-scale invasion of Ukraine. I'm Tommy McNeil, VOA News.
Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Barte, Washington. Today is Wednesday, July 10th, and here are some of the stories we are following. Burundi and Rwanda agree to normalize relations.
We agreed to meet by 31st of October this year in order to go through the pending issues, outstanding issues that are between the two countries.
Ethiopian Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed pays a one-day visit to Sudan. South Sudan marks 13th independence anniversary as women recall their contribution. Cameroon's opposition calls a purported poll postponement a ploy to extend the tenure of the country's long-serving president. Kenya's Gen Z movement accuses opposition leader Raila Odinga of trying to hijack their campaign.
On Tuesday in Nairobi, we saw the Kenyan opposition leader, Raila Odinga, joining hands with the embattled president, William Ruto, saying that he had agreed to dialogue.
And Nigeria's Customs Service signs an MOU with China to curb the illicit flow of arms and drugs. Those stories and more are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Burundi and Rwanda have agreed to meet and normalize their relations. This comes after deteriorating ties between the two countries led to the closure of their mutual borders. Moses Javier Rimana reports.
Burundi and Rwanda officials are set to meet by 31st October to discuss outstanding issues affecting their bilateral relations. The move was agreed during a retreat of the ministers responsible for the East African Community Affairs and ministers of foreign affairs from the eight member states on Monday in Zanzibar. Olivier Nduhungirehe is Rwanda's Minister of Foreign Affairs and International Cooperation.
We agreed that we will discuss and solve our issues bilaterally. We agreed to meet by 31st of October this year in order to go through the pending issues, outstanding issues that are between the two countries. And we have demonstrated, Minister Albert Shinjiro and I, that we are committed to find solution for the brotherly people of Rwanda and Burundi.
Through his ex account, formerly known as Twitter, Burundi's Foreign Affairs Minister Albert Shingiro said that a diplomatic window is a powerful tool for resolving conflicts, tensions, and paradoxes between states. Burundi had closed its borders with neighboring Rwanda in January, paralyzing transborder trade. Jean Bosco Kalisa is the chief executive officer of the East African Business Council.
We really applaud and appreciate the resolution that was signed in Zanzibar, and really urge you, all the partners, all the parties, to fast track the implementation of the resolution. And this is going to really restore our trade and investment across the region.
In January, Burundi closed all its land borders with neighboring Rwanda, accusing Kigali of supporting a rebel group based in DRC that attacked and killed dozens of people in the country last year. Rwanda has repeatedly denied the allegations. Fred Mukasambide is an East African analyst and vice president of the Democratic Party in Uganda. He says that peace between the two countries could revamp their economies and trade.
The Zanzibar meeting obviously gives East Africa a breath of life, particularly seeking to institutionalize peace support operations and, of course, a conclusion on fast-tracking of the EAC Mutual Defense Pact. And the prescribed meeting between Burundi and Rwanda obviously then seeks to deliver the otherwise much-needed entente that guarantees the net trade between the two countries that had alone had existed. So, in my opinion, peace is more profitable between Burundi and Rwanda than anything to the contrary.
The government of Burundi says that if relations are to be normalized, Rwanda should hand over former Burundian army officials and some opposition leaders it accuses of plotting the failed coup in 2015 to oust former President Pierre Nkurunziza. Moses Avyarimana for Voice of America.
Ethiopian Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed paid a one-day visit to Sudan on Tuesday. Reuters reports that Abe met with Sudan's Army Chief of General Staff, Abdel Fattah al-Burhan, in his war capital of Port Sudan. Sudan has been engulfed in a 15-month conflict between the army and the paramilitary rapid support forces, RSF, which has displaced nearly 10 million people. Brooke Hailu is adjunct professor in the Department of Political Science and International Relations at Addis Ababa University. He tells me the prime minister's visit was aimed at finding solutions to the conflict.
Main goal and purpose of the visit of the Egyptian prime minister, Abiy Ahmed, to Sudan, this time around in the port city of Port Sudan, is to continue with the efforts of the peace process. In that respect, I think it is time that Ethiopia and other horn countries will come on board and find a solution to this heart-wrenching, heart-breaking episode of continuous civil war and devastation of the Sudanese people and society. So in that respect, from what we hear from Addis and other sources, the Ethiopian leader, the prime minister, had made progress. He was warmly welcomed by the Sudanese military leader, General al-Burhan, and both have agreed to continue the peace effort to bring the much, much long-awaited peace, ceasefire, cessation of hostilities among the two warring factions, armed warring factions of the Sudanese army, al-Burhan, and the rapid deployment forces of General Hermiti Dangalo.
As you know, yes, there have been several attempts about brokering peace in Sudan.
Yes.
So did he take any specific suggestion to the general in Sudan?
A good question. Details have not come out, but one thing that was disclosed by the Ethiopian foreign minister as well, since their return to Addis, the Ethiopian foreign minister, Ambassador Taye, had given a press conference to journalists. He said that we are now back again on track to continue the peace efforts. And Ethiopia, as a good neighbor, as a brotherly people of the Sudan, sharing long borders, history, culture, and the people who live on both sides of the border, is committed to play as a never-expected role to bring about peace. So that's what we know so far.
Also, I think we have spoken before, Ethiopia has been involved in this dispute with Somalia about port access. Is it possible that Prime Minister Abe may have discussed with the Sudanese general about port access?
Well, always, by the way, in the case of port access with the Sudan, for years, you know, there is a rapport between the two countries because Port Sudan is also nearer to the northwestern part of Ethiopia. There was many years ago of reworking the highway from the Ethiopian border city of Matamba in the Amhara region all the way to Port Sudan. So whether that issue has been discussed or not has not been disclosed so far, either by the foreign minister or by other Ethiopian Ministry of Foreign Affairs officials. But if this issue was raised, I would not be surprised. But one thing is for sure. The main goal and reason of the Prime Minister Abiy going to Port Sudan to meet the President of the Sudan was primarily to focus and to zoom on the peace efforts, continue the peace efforts of the Sudan.
Brooke Hailu is the adjunct professor in the Department of Political Science and International Relations at Addis Ababa University. He was speaking with us from the southern U.S. state of North Carolina. Kenyan youth who make up the Gen Z movement have accused opposition leader Raila Odinga of trying to hijack their campaign that sparked weeks of anti-tax protests. The Kenyan Nation online publication reports that the youth on Tuesday rejected a move by President William Ruto and Odinga to hold a national dialogue to address the issues that sparked weeks of anti-government protests. Mwangi Maina is a Kenyan journalist with the Kenyan Foreign Policy online publication. He tells me the proposed dialogue is expected to take place between July 15th and the 20th.
The Gen Z have
from the onset said that they are not going to dialogue with the government because they are a leaderless movement and a faceless movement. They gave some demands to the government, one of them including the dissolvement of the entire cabinet, which of course President William Ruto has taken a bit of some time before dissolving it. On Tuesday in Nairobi, we saw the Kenyan opposition leader, Raila Odinga, joining hands with the embattled President William Ruto, saying that he had agreed to dialogue, and the GNZs have come out gun blazing and saying, you know, blasting the veteran opposition leader and rejecting his unsolicited views on President Ruto's plan to include political players in a multi-sectoral dialogue to address issues raised by Kenyans over intense protests against the finance bill 2024. Raila, who is a septuagenarian, 79-year-old, has been accused by the country's Gen Z of attempting to hijack the illegitimate movement. They have, in one or the other, written some strongly worded statements accusing the former premier of siding with their oppressor, who is President William Ruto, against whom they have protested and called for his resignation.
But how can President Ruto or Raila Odinga engage them physically when they themselves have said that their movement is leaderless?
James, from the kind of engagement I had with the Gen Z during the protest, is that they are maintaining a leaderless movement and a faceless movement because it's well known that you cannot be able to catch smoke. You have seen in Kenya that the government has in one or the other tried to crack down on this protest, and they have been banging on the doors of few individuals who they thought are the leaders of this particular movement, but who unto them they did manage to get the organizational chart of this particular youthful movement. So to me, and from where I sit, I think it's a way of trying to show that the country has come to an age where people can be able to engage without following a leader.
So this proposed forum that I think is supposed to run from July 15th to the 20th, what do you think they are going to be talking about?
Specifically, what they're going to be talking about is that the political governance and the culture, the political culture in the country. They want to address the kind of the mess that the country has been plagued with since independence. But we are still waiting to see what will happen next week on Monday, on the 15th, when this particular, you know, dialogue will be starting. The young people have said no, that Raila Odinga, no, William Ruto speaks for them.
Mwangi Maina is a Kenya journalist with the Kenya Foreign Policy Online publication. He was speaking with us from the capital, Nairobi. You're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Wednesday, July 10th. For more African news and features, visit our website at voaafrica.com. Connect with us on all social media platforms. On social media platforms, we are on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. South Sudan celebrated 13 years of independence yesterday, Tuesday. In a message, U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken called on South Sudan leaders to guarantee their people a future of peace and stability and choose their leaders through genuine and peaceful elections. He also urged the transitional government in Juba to be transparent in its use of public financial resources for the good of all South Sudanese. South Sudan women who participated in the independence struggle are calling on their government to remember their contributions. For VOA News, Katuma Vanessa files from Torit in eastern Equatorial State.
July 9th marks the 30th anniversary of South Sudan's independence from Sudan after 21 years of fighting between the rebel Sudan People's Liberation Army and the Sudan Armed Forces. In what was then known as Southern Sudan, the struggle for independence was the hope for a brighter future. The women of South Sudan were active in liberation causes, providing food and shelter to soldiers and caring for children and the wounded fighters. Some of these women now feel the government of South Sudan have forgotten them. Eunice Nakiru Laku, a women's leader in Torit Town, says the South Sudan government should reward women for their contribution during the independence struggle.
There is those who are bringing water, firewood. There is those who can even grind and bring food. There is those who can go and look for wild fruits. There is those who can go and collect even the green vegetables from the bush so that our men continue to fight, and when they come back, they can have food to eat. And this is our contribution as women. So then we, as women, we say, what is our role then? We fought together. We worked together. We helped you. But now you decided to say we are women. We should stay home and take care of the children.
Imuta Lili Lox is married to one of the independence fighters. She says women were the backbone of the struggle.
Nuswana kanfi nagde na kangili suforwa. Zaman japa tausika ta Uganda. Yashu ya najaligo, Uganda ya za sadina.
We suffered all this while with no clothes. We were putting on animal skin as cloth. We were on the border of Uganda. Ugandans were the ones who brought clothes, and we exchanged with a goat or chicken to buy clothes. Our suffering was too much. Now that we have independence, guns have stopped until our men got peace. But after the peace, we found ourselves in more suffering.
Lucia Loyana Moy, who also is married to a freedom fighter, says the government should remember women's crucial role during the struggle for independence.
All these areas I have moved to, and in all these bushes, I have moved with a lot of suffering. No water, no shoes on the feet. We used to drink blood if an animal was killed. The baby that I gave birth to in the bush, I used to give her urine as water for drinking. We are still suffering as before when we were in the bush. If I can find those I used to cook for, maybe they would have helped me.
Women in South Sudan still face hardship. Food insecurity, scarcity of clean water, political instability, weather extreme such as severe droughts and floods, lack of infrastructure and health care. For VOA News, I am Kaltuma Vanessa, reporting in Torit, Eastern Equatorial State.
Cameroon opposition and civil society leaders say a law passed on Tuesday to extend lawmakers' mandates by a year is a ploy by President Paul Biya. They say the goal is to eliminate opposition leaders who plan to qualify as candidates for the country's 2025 presidential polls. But the government argues a lack of funds makes it impossible to organize election as planned. Moki Edwin Kinzeka reports from Yaoundé, Cameroon.
Lawmakers with the ruling Cameroon People's Democratic Movement, or CPDM, applauded on Tuesday after passing a law to extend their term of office for 1 year. The lawmakers were elected in 2020 to serve a 5-year term, expiring on March 10, 2025. But this week, President Paul Biya asked his government to pass a bill extending terms for the 180 members of parliament by 12 months, well into 2026. Government officials say Cameroon's constitution gives Biya the power to consult the Constitutional Council and ask parliament to vote on extensions and postpone elections whenever circumstances warrant. Joshua Osi, a lawmaker and president of the opposition Social Democratic Front, disagrees.
Le SDF est contre cette prorogation.
Osi says the Social Democratic Front party he leads strongly condemns as undemocratic the law extending the mandate of parliamentarians, postponing parliamentary elections in Cameroon from February 2025 to February 2026. He says the Cameroon government had 5 years to prepare for fresh polls in 2025 and should not give the impression that it was taken by surprise. Biya's CPDM, which holds 156 of 180 parliamentary seats passed the bill into law. Opposition and civil society groups say Biya ordered CPDM lawmakers to vote on the bill because it makes it difficult for some main opposition leaders, including Maurice Kamto of the Cameroon Renaissance Movement Party, or CRM, to be a candidate in presidential elections expected in October 2025. Kamto claims he won Cameroon's October 7 presidential polls and that his victory was stolen by President Biya. In 2020, his party did not take part in local council and parliamentary elections, claiming that Biya had planned to rig the polls in favor of CPDM. Cameroonian laws state that a political leader who aspires to be president must be in a political party that has at least a municipal councillor or is represented by a lawmaker in parliament. Kamto's CRM party has neither. The CRM says it expected to take part in February's local and parliamentary elections to be able to endorse Kamto. Kamto says the law extending the term of parliamentarians, along with a presidential decision postponing local elections, is another ploy by Biya, age 91, to remain leader for life. He spoke in a press conference this week in Yaoundé. He says he wants to reiterate to the government of Cameroon that his party and followers will not tolerate plans by Biya to stay in power at all costs. Moki Edwin Kinzeka, VOA News, Yaoundé, Cameroon.
The Nigerian Customs Service has signed a memorandum of understanding with China, with another pact imminent with Turkey and India to curb the illicit flows of arms, drugs, and fake goods into the country. This, as security agencies intensify a probe on the importation of large consignments of arms through the ports. Chief Superintendent Abdullahi Aliyu Maiwada is the spokesperson for the Nigeria Customs Service. He told viewers Chinedu Oforward that the lives of Nigerian citizens are at stake.
We are out to protect the lives of Nigerians. That is why we have concern over the desperation by some individuals to import items that are inimical to security and well-being of Nigerians. If we suppress the smuggling of items that have effects on the environment, for instance, items that are endangered species of flora and fauna, items that are e-waste, that we are protecting the environment. If we deter drugs, illicit drugs, from coming into Nigeria, that we are protecting the health of the citizens. When we intercept arms and ammunition, we are trying to ensure the security of the nations. For instance, in the interception of endangered species, we have intercepted items such as pangolin skulls, elephant tusks. We have even succeeded in prosecuting some of the suspects. Now, in the area of drugs, we have intercepted so many of these drugs in Tinkan Island Port in Lagos, in Apapa Port in Lagos, recently in Oné Port in Port Harcourt. Now, for the illicit items that have to do with the security of the country, we have intercepted some arms and ammunition earlier in Tinkan. We have intercepted arms and ammunition recently in Port Harcourt. And we have intercepted arms and ammunition and military equipment. So the interception of these items is to save Nigeria economically, socially, health-wise, and environmentally.
There are reports that the Nigerian Customs have signed an MOU with China in terms of illicit importation of certain products. What exactly does the MOU say?
Precisely in May 2024, the Comptroller General of Customs visited the People's Republic of China and also at the same time watched the illicit importation of items that are substandard and other issues relating to e-commerce.
Your boss, the Comptroller General, talked about reversing the trend where Nigeria used to be a dumping ground for substandard and illicit items and manufactured equipment, and that you're looking at also having the same MOU with Turkey and also with India.
Most of the drugs we intercept comes from India, and this raised alarm and called for such kind of bilateral engagements. The controlling general felt there is absolute need to come up with a kind of bilateral agreement between Nigeria and India to stop the smuggling of illicit drugs. On the other hand, in Turkey, it's also related to importation of small arms and light weapons into Nigeria from Turkey. So that MOU is a little bit dormant. Now, the consolidation of previous gain is to resuscitate that MOU and see where we need to improve on it and implement it to the letter.
Chief Superintendent Abdullahi Aliu Maiwada is the spokesman for the Nigeria Customs Service. He was speaking from Abuja with viewers Chinedu Ofor. And that's it for this Wednesday, July 10th edition of Daybreak Africa. We thank you for coming aboard with us this morning. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, I'm James Butte in Washington, wishing that you will have a lovely day.